we're thinking that perhaps it was the Tibetan tradition of too much black tea over decades, washing away all his electrolytes and potassium, and so they're requesting that he cut down on drinking too much caffeine black tea and drink more water. So how's that for a problem? What a thing to ask a Tibetan, you know? But how wonderful for us. And so this afternoon, this morning, we're going to do more of the prayers for the success of the Kala Chakra in India at Amaravati, one of these holy places in India. And so it's also for the success of His Holiness's teaching. And let me read this email to you. So we'll spend the last half hour of our class doing mantras. It says, Sashidele, please find a letter which is in Puyik, or the Tibetan language, from the Department of Culture and Religion regarding prayers for His Holiness's well-being, especially during the 2006 Amaravati Kala Chakra initiation. So with this, they're asked each of us to recite at least 1,000 Tupe Tsenak, which means the name mantra of Shakyamuni Buddha. So that's the one with the card that Annie passed out to you. It says, Om Muni Muni Mahamuniye Soha. That is the mantra of Shakyamuni Buddha, the historical Buddha. And so if you can do 1,000 of the mantras, that would be wonderful. And then an infinite number of Chinrezig mantras. So that is the mantra of the Buddha of Compassion. And let's see, that's the thousand arm Chinrezig up there. And also in the image there as well. So we'll be doing that for the well-being of His Holiness, but I think, you know, let's also add for the well-being of Venerable Geshe Gelson, for his long life, so that the center can continue well, and we all can work together to continue to bring the Dharma to Southern California. Okay, so we'll do that in the last half hour. But so anyway, Geshe-la is well and resting, and he's been asked to rest, so that's why I'm filling in this morning. So let's do the prayers in English this morning. It's an opportunity to go through them. I especially like them because it incorporates the Seven Limb Puja, which is an excellent practice. Before anyone begins a meditation period or before you begin your study, because it just helps clear the mind. It's also really excellent in accumulating virtue and purifying negativities. Okay, so we'll start with refuge. And as we say the refuge, really again, it's incorporating not only just recitation, but really thinking, using your mind and visualization. So as you say this refuge formula, really think of the qualities of the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha. And the gurus really represent all of those qualities. Okay? So contemplate them for a moment. Really imagine the Buddha sitting before you. The Buddha being non-different than His Holiness the Dalai Lama, non-different than Geshe-la, non-different than your pure enlightened potential. And with a sense of deep respect and gratitude, we'll say the refuge formula. I take refuge in my gurus. I take refuge in the Buddha. I take refuge in the Dharma. I take refuge in the Sangha. I take refuge in my gurus. I take refuge in the Buddha. I take refuge in the Dharma. I take refuge in the Sangha. I take refuge in my gurus. I take refuge in the Buddha. I take refuge in the Dhamma. I take refuge in the Sangha. Okay, so the first verse of the Lama Tsongkhapa Guru Yoga is inviting the lamas to come to this place. So again, you know, it's really thinking in your mind of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. Here specifically, we're calling to mind Lama Tsongkhapa, who was the person, the eminence who really started the Gelugpa lineage in the 14th century in Tibet. He was Tibetan and an incredible author, incredible practitioner, incredible monk, incredible teacher. So, you know, when you read about Lama Tsongkhapa's life, really, if you take any one aspect of what he did, it's like he took each of those aspects to a very full completion. So these statues here are of Lama Tsongkhapa, in the center, and then his two disciples on either side of him. So that is a representation of Lama Tsongkhapa. Okay, so again, in calling to mind the lamas to your visualization, to your presence, then you know it also is a way of exercising your mind, exercising your really your faith, and really imagining their qualities and being in the presence of enlightened masters. Okay, so let's think of that for a moment. And we'll recite the first verse. From the heart of the Ganden Devas emerges a brilliant white cloud like a great mass of fresh yogurt. Atop sits Tsongkhapa, all-knowing king of Dharma. We request your coming to this place along with your great disciples. So the second one is, the second verse is, again, thinking of the qualities of Lama Tsongkhapa, being non-different than your teacher as well. So it's requesting that they live for a long, long time, and also to request teachings. Okay, so I'll say that next verse. My Lord Guru is seated before me on a lion throne, lotus, and moon cushion. His white face smiles blissfully. Please remain many eons and serve as the supreme merit field for the growth of my mind of faith and for the increase of Lord Buddha's teaching. And then the next one as well is talking about the qualities of the body, speech, and mind of Lama Tsongkhapa, and also then doing the first limb of the seven limb, which is prostration. So it's Geshe-la likes to say when we do the prostration, it's body, speech, and mind, a prostration of body, speech, and mind. So we do the physical prostrations when we bowed, and then the verbal when we recite this, and then the mental of really taking sincere refuge and thinking about the qualities of our Buddha potential. So we'll say the next verse. Your omniscient wisdom mind encompasses all that is existent. Your speech is a profound teaching which ornaments the ear of the fortunate. Your body's beautiful radiance evokes wondrous admiration. I prostrate to you, Lama Tsongkhapa, whom merely viewing, hearing, or contemplating earns one great merit. So the next verse incorporates the second limb, which is the limb of offering. So these are offerings of here, delightful offerings. So these are physical offerings and then mental offerings. So let's think for a moment of all the things that benefit and encourage and inspire you Okay, think of those things and the qualities of them, realizing that offerings are a way of practicing generosity, helping expand our sense of giving. And this particular verse, like Geshe-la says, you know, when we do especially mental offerings, we can make them limitless, right? We can imagine, like they say, filling the skies. So even if we only have $10 in our pocket, right? We can imagine a wealth of offerings extending limitlessly. So you can make your offerings as vast as possible, particularly thinking about how when people give you very sincere gifts and things, how that pleases our mind. And you know, it's also turning our mind to the teachers and showing some appreciation for the teachings that we have received over the years from Geshe-la. Now, Geshe-la's been teaching here 29 years already. Can you imagine? Non-stop flow of teachings. And so, you know, with a sense of real appreciation, we just offer back these offerings of, you know, that here they're like the sense offerings. So you can think of, let's see how that says here, water for drinking, flowers for sight and smell, incense, butter lamps, so that these beautiful, realizing that the butter lamps are offering light that brings illumination and clarity to the mind, makes the mind happy, perfumes and more. So physical and mental offerings. You can imagine the most inspiring Dharma books or conversations or teachings that you've received. You know, just imagine these places that have really inspired you, places that you've been to in the world that have been breathtaking. Breathtaking. You know, and imagine offering those, that just giving back, you know. It's like, really, we have the good karma to appreciate such things, you know. And it's really by the accumulation and collection of our good karma that we can even appreciate them. Because you know, when you're filled with anxiety or turmoil or anger, that no matter where we are, you know, we can't appreciate what's going on. So realizing that it's a calm, peaceful, open, receptive state of mind that we can even appreciate such offerings. So in turn, you know, giving it back and offering it to our teachers and to all beings. Okay, so let's sit for a moment, really think about what you have appreciated in life and imagine offering them back. So even a simple glass of water. Now remember a time when you were really thirsty, and just a simple glass of water, quenching your thirst. Imagine offering pure water to everyone, everywhere. And let's recite the next verse. I present to you, supreme field of merit, Tsongkhapa, delightful offerings, pure sweet water, various flowers, fragrant incense, butter lamps, perfumes, and more, both physical and mental offerings, vast as the clouds and wide as the ocean. And the next limb is the limb of purification or confession, also to help us clear out our system mentally and physically so that our minds can be cooled out when we do our meditations. So this particular limb then has four parts to it. You might call to mind a specific incident where it was really a diminishing of your qualities by the actions that you engaged in, maybe through really harsh and angersome words, maybe striking out at someone in your own selfishness or intolerance, things that were done that were really unskillful. And you know that was really hurtful. So you can call to mind a specific incident that you had engaged in. And again, this particular limb is called chakpa. It means cutting open, laying bare. So in other words, rather than stuffing it away and hiding it away, you cut it open and declare it. And just, it's almost like saying to Geshe-la, saying to the Buddhas, saying to His Holiness, you know, it's like, this was an unkind act. It was diminishing, you know? And declare it. And so in declaring it, you're not running around with adding more guilt to your situation, right? But it's a declaration of saying, you know, I realize that this was a harmful act. And so you declare it, admit it, and then the third part is that you make a promise not to engage in that action again. Hopefully for the rest of your life or forever, but if you realize it's kind of a habitual pattern that you don't want to do it again, you know, it's like you declare it and see it and say, I promise not to commit this action again, you know, for a month or for a week. So it begins to build your strength in keeping up with, you know, your promise or your wish to really develop your virtuous actions. Okay, so then the last part of it is to really think of what you can do to bring it into your world and into your life in the way of some remedial action. So to do something that is beneficial for your neighbor or for your co-workers, or to that person that you might have committed that action, to apologize to them if that person has already passed on and gone. You can do it mentally. You know? Imagine sitting with that person who's already passed on and making that sincere, you know, apology to that person. So that this one has four parts. So let's sit quietly for a moment, and I'll just run through them. You might think of just one specific incident, you know, so slowly working them away, unless you have a very general, you know, scope. You might want to think of a specific action that occurred. So call that incident to mind. And see it as harmful to yourself and others. A diminishing of who you aspire to be. And just declare it. So again, it's not a sense of creating more guilt, but just a comprehension that it is harmful. And then make a promise to refrain from that action for a specific amount of time. And think of the amount of time that you can be successful with it. And think of some remedial action that you can engage in to apologize or to just do something kind for a friend or a neighbor. You don't have to tell them what it's about, but it's just something in yourself so that you can take it, that promise, out into the world. recite the next verse? The unwholesome actions of body, speech, and mind I have accumulated since time without beginning, especially actions contrary to my three vows, Vinaya, Bodhisattva, Vajrayana. I regret extremely from the depths of my heart and reveal each and every such action. And so the next limb is the limb of rejoicing. Rejoicing is one of the most beautiful and easy ways to create merit. Makes the mind happy, makes others happy. And so consider the qualities of His Holiness the Dalai Lama, of the Buddha, of Geshe-la. Really have a lot of joy in what they have done and brought into the world. And then also think of your own good qualities, yeah, and rejoice in those, because that generates merit and gives us energy, just natural, spontaneous energy to progress along the path. And we'll recite the next line. We totally rejoice in your magnificent achievements, my Lord. You strove for knowledge and realization, abandoned the eight worldly concerns, and made the most meaningful use of human life with the 18 opportune conditions during these degenerate times. So the next verse is about requesting teachings. So let's continue to ask Geshe-la to turn the wheel of Dharma. Turning the wheel of Dharma is turning the wheel of teachings. No, request. That's what he's here for. No. And he would have been teaching here, he would have been teaching in Tibet if not for the tragedy and demise of what happened in Tibet. So, you know, we're so fortunate to have Geshe-la with us. To really think of continuing to request teachings and to request His Holiness the Dalai Lama to continue to give teachings as well. You know, this is the in Buddhism they talk about our teachers how the Buddhas don't wash away our negativities or I forget the term. Anyway, they can't wash away our negativities, but they help us by teaching. No, it's through teaching that we really can come to our own happiness and enlightenment. So it's really the teachings, and not just the teachings, but putting the teachings into practice. So the teachers teach us, but we're the ones who have to practice. Okay, so. Let's think about that. Think about the teachings that you have received from Geshe-la over the years, and also what teachings you would like to receive, and imagine requesting that. So let's think of that for a moment. We'll recite the next verse. Pray all you holy gurus, unerring in conduct, precipitated rain of vast and profound Dharma, from the billowing clouds of wisdom and compassion which fill the Dharmakaya sky, providing for the field of disciples precisely what is needed. And the next verse is asking them to stay and remain with us. It's requesting their long life, and it's, they say, indirectly creates the causes for our own long life. Yeah? So let's think of that for a moment, and then we'll recite the verse. think of the causes and conditions that even arose for your interest in the Dharma. And so now that you have the interest, how important it is to have teachers. We'll recite the next verse. May the Vajra body, created from the purity of clear light, free of the rising and setting of cyclic existence, but visible to the ordinary viewer, only in its unsubtle physical form, stay on, unchanging, without waning, until samsara ends. And the last limb of the seven limbs is dedication. So dedicating all the merit that you have accumulated. Think of waking up this morning and determining that you were going to come to class, even if Geshe Lo was here, or even if you didn't know Geshe Lo was coming to teach today, and making the journey all the way down from Santa Monica and elsewhere. It requires a lot of effort on our part too, you know, to be here. And so think of the merit and really setting the dedication and the motivation to acknowledge the efforts that you put in for your own spiritual practice, and that this creates the causes for you also to meet the Dharma and to meet excellent teachers again and again. Okay, so we'll recite the dedication verse. May whatever virtue I've gathered here beneficially serve all sentient beings and the Buddha Dhamma, and especially may the essential teachings of the unerring Master, Tsongkhapa, shine forever. Okay, and we'll recite Lama Tsongkhapa's verse. Let's just do it once today so we can keep moving on, because we need to take time for our recitations. Jason Kapha, crown jewel of the holy masters of the land of snows, you are Avalokiteshvara, great treasure of inconceivable compassion, untainted by ego's delusion. You are Manjushri, powerful master with stainless wisdom. You are Vajrapani, destroyer of forces of demons. At your feet, famed Lelsang Kapha, I humbly bow and earnestly request that all sentient beings achieve enlightenment. So Losung Kapa is the same as Jason Kapa. Okay, that one is his ordination name, and then one is his, like a title. Song means onion. He was the person from the places of onions. Song Kapa. So, So in this, the next three verses, then you're imagining and inviting your guru to come to the lotus seat on the crown of your head. So you imagine inviting the Buddha, imagine enlightened energy, the Buddha energy coming to the crown of your head, sitting on the crown of your head. So the image of the Buddha is very tiny, made of light, made of your good intention. So you imagine the Buddha sitting on the crown of your head. And now Geshe Lo continually says the visualization is more important than the mantra. So, you know, it's using your mind to imagine inviting enlightened energy to the crown of your head. The second verse, you imagine that Lama Tsongkhapa or the Buddha dissolves into light and descends through the crown of your head and comes down through your central channel and then rests again at your heart. Okay, so then at your heart it becomes non-different than your own enlightened potential. Then the third verse means that they are they completely merge. Yeah, that part of not being non-different. Okay, so let's do the visualization. And invite the Buddha to the crown of your head, very tiny. made of light. Glorious precious root guru, please take the lotus seat at my crown, and in your kindness, please care for us. Bestow upon us the attainments of your body, speech, and mind. Glorious precious root guru, please take the lotus seat at my heart, and in your great kindness, care for us. Grant us your blessings for our temporal success and for the supreme attainment. Glorious precious root guru, please take the lotus seat at our hearts, and in your great kindness, remain with us. Remain steadfast until we achieve the essence of enlightenment. So just sit with that for a moment. Imagine that the Buddha energy is non-different than your own enlightened potential. To the refuge and development of bodhicitta, the last verse on page 3. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened to the Buddhas, the Dharma, and the highest assembly. From the virtuous merit of this teaching, the Dharma, may I attain Buddhahood for the benefit of all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened to the Buddhas, the Dharma, and the highest assembly. From the virtuous merit of this teaching, may I attain Buddhahood for the benefit of all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened to the Buddhas, the Dharma, and the highest assembly. From the virtuous merit of teaching the Dharma, may I attain Buddhahood for the benefit of all sentient beings. So this verse says, I go for refuge until when? until we are enlightened. So, how soon is that? Until we're enlightened. So, thinking, we could work with that line for a long time, because you realize that, in fact, we've been taking refuge in all kinds of things all our lives. And, in fact, even though we may say this refuge formula, that we keep shifting off into all kinds of other refuges. Right? All kinds of other refuges. So, anything come to mind? We take refuge in people.
Work.
Food. Food, yes. What else does a monastic have left?
The couch,
okay. Couch potato, television, the media, our possessions, sex, drinking, rock and roll,
gambling,
money, yeah,
exercise,
shopping, okay, born to shop, right. Yeah, we take refuge in all kinds of, our bodies, our minds, our physical prowess, how do you say that?
Prowess?
A lot of things, isn't it? We take refuge in all kinds of other things. So when we say I take refuge until I'm enlightened, you know, it just kind of keeps bringing our attention back to some essentials rather than those rather illusory, transitory, running through our fingers, other kind of refuges, which you realize are ephemeral and not lasting, right? I mean, I know that one about eating really well, right? You find something really delicious, you want more, and what happens if you eat more, right? And the same thing with sex, drugs, and rock and roll, isn't it? After 3 hours at a concert, you need a little silence. Just like that with our bodies, you know, our bodies, which we take refuge in as when we're young and we find ourselves being so svelte and happy and strong, right? What happens when we start getting older? Okay. So the same thing, all these things that we took refuge in over our lives and we keep doing so, begin to show up as we hang out and keep checking and analyzing what is it that I've been taking refuge in over my years, and seeing that it is completely dissatisfactory, causes more craving and grasping. You know? This whole bit about how our media and advertising keep going to the bank, keep going to the bank, banking on our dissatisfaction by firing up this wish of, you know, you need this in order to be satisfied. That if you get this new car or this new iPod or this new person or this new shirt, then you'll be happy. Right? Until the next season clothes come out or the upgrade comes up. And then you feel dissatisfied again. Now, so you realize that though we need and have to rely on these things, like especially food, you know, we need food. We can't just go cold turkey on food. We need food to survive, you see. How do we develop a balance with this? You know, and so looking at the qualities of how do I live my life, realizing that I need to rely on certain things, but that, you know, they are not lasting, ultimately changing. So this is why, you know, we need to continue to look at what we take refuge in. And so many of you took refuge recently with Geshe-la. So for those of you who recently took refuge, today I wanted to go over some of the precepts. So for those of you who took refuge recently, what are those precepts?
Abstinence from drugs and alcohol and altered mind.
Abstinence from drugs and alcohol, okay.
No immoral sex.
No more sex?
Immoral sex.
Oh. That's a monastic vow then.
Yeah.
No immoral sex, okay.
No lying.
No lying?
No stealing.
No stealing?
No killing.
No killing. Okay, we got them all. Okay, so those are considered Vinaya vows, or self-liberation vows. Vows that help you through your own liberation, that help actually clear your mind so that you can start to see what the Buddha was really talking about. This is the method aspect of the teachings, right? The method aspect so that we can understand the wisdom aspect. Yeah? So all of these teachings of the Buddha can be divided into method and wisdom. These vows that we take are the method aspect so that we can begin to clear our mind to understand what the Buddha was saying about the nature of reality and egolessness, selflessness. I was reading something from Pema Chodron, and I thought it was really great because she said, you know, when we start talking about egolessness, our minds just go spaced out, you know, but when we talk about our neuroses, you know, we're really comfortable with that. No. So we kind of delve in all the neurotic aspects and seeing, you know, this nature of mind so that we can really understand the nature of consciousness and reality. Okay, so the precepts then are for individual liberation, right? So even my monastic vows are for individual liberation, to help us to get clear so that we can understand the higher teachings. You know? So it also helps us to understand our interrelatedness, our interdependence with all others and with all phenomena. You know? When you're killing, stealing, lying, and harming others with your sex and making yourself completely obliterated through drugs and alcohol, then how can you really understand your interrelatedness with others? But you're just forming a very hard, hard boundary of how you relate. You know? So these precepts then really help us wake up to our interrelatedness, to interdependence. And it also helps us points out our self-centeredness and our selfishness. So, you know, you realize too that when our ethics are out, that's when things start to fall apart in our lives, you know. And when you're wanting to engage in things that are against these precepts, you realize that you're imposing your self-interest and your selfishness, imposing that, and then what happens is, you know, your karma bites back. The world bites back at you eventually. We think we're doing what is going to be pleasurable and self-serving, but in fact, you know, it is also very temporary. Okay, so these precepts then help us to understand the view. So when we take refuge in the Buddha, yeah, Buddha means awakened mind. There's the historical Buddha. When we recite the Om Mani Mani Maha Muni Yesoha mantra, that's the Buddha mantra. It's the historical Buddha. So that's the Buddha who lived 2,500 years ago. But there's also the enlightened potential. That's what Buddha actually means, enlightened mind. So when we take refuge and we're looking at the possibility or the potential of us attaining enlightened mind. So just like in doing the seven limb practice, which we did this morning, you know, it's purifying all negativities and accumulating all virtuous qualities. You could say that is a definition of Buddha, is having completely purified all negativities and accumulated all virtuous qualities. So that is our potential. So so let's, again, when we say we are Buddhist, in Tibetan, the name is Nangpa, and it means an inner one. So our practice is more on the inside, rather than, it's also outside, but really what we're working on is transforming the mind and consciousness. Okay, so let's look at this first precept of killing. Now, sometimes when teachers give the refuge precepts, they say that in taking refuge, you have to take at least one precept. Some of the teachers say you have to take all five to really take refuge with them. So in taking one precept, generally they say you have to take the precept of not killing. Okay, the precept of not killing. So let's look at that for a moment. Does someone who took refuge recently have any comment on that, in how they've been practicing and upholding that precept? Yeah. Anybody practicing? Frank.
Well, it took me a while to realize that also rules out suicide. And initially, I was really focused on stepping on ants, the struggle with the vegetarianism, of trying to devote a certain amount of days per year for non-meaning. And that's some of the way it's worked in my life. I think that's a fairly straightforward precept. There's not a lot of gray space. I mean, you're either killing or you're not.
Yeah.
If you look at some of the others, you know, lying and stealing could be interpreted in many different ways, I think.
Uh-huh.
I mean, killing is fairly well explained.
Okay. Did everybody hear okay? All right. Frank was saying that killing is fairly black and white compared to some of the other precepts, and that it includes not only not stepping on ants or even trying to practice vegetarianism, but also the idea that we should not commit suicide, and to what's that? That was it. Okay. Any other comments on how you've been practicing with this one?
I've just been finding more of a connection with insects.
Okay. Been finding more of a connection with insects. Okay, like Shirley.
Yeah, it's a difficult one when it comes down to the insects.
Mm-hmm.
The idea of killing anything is so beyond my comprehension for me.
Right.
But then there's the insects. And I told the story about where I tried to catch the bee with a cup and I beheaded it. And I was just devastated. So it's made me, I don't know that you can stop. You can't, you drive and bugs come on your farm and
right.
You walk and you're stepping on, you know, microscopic beings, but at least my consciousness has arisen to a place where when I see a spider or a bee, I make every attempt to get it moved outside the house.
Right. When we see other insects, then we're not trying to eliminate them, but to try to usher them to a safer place. And to help them. And so, you know, even thinking about how just in our living we're displacing other sentient creatures, that to come to class we're probably killing a great number of bugs on our car.
Mm-hmm. How about people kill many birds because they think I'm killing them?
People kill a lot of birds because of the bird flu. Yes, right.
Obviously, it's a good intention, you know. They try to prevent the calamity for humans and also maybe for other animals. And that obviously, they collect some kind of merit, but at the same time, they create, killing.
Yes, we create killing by eliminating a lot of birds, even with the motivation to keep people safe. But where did all those birds come from? No, it also came from this idea of production of food, and so we're breeding animals for our consumption. So in our living, we're creating a lot of the process of, you know, it's something to really look at in a broader scope rather than just in our own experience. What are we doing? And so also in the proliferation of sales of guns and the proliferation of the military and war and gang fighting in our communities. So on a broader level, there are many levels of killing that that go on, and to look at on a societal, political power struggle, how are we perpetuating that as well? So no, and looking at this one about food is really, really interesting. There's one young person I was working with, and he said one of his first jobs out of high school was to work in a pig slaughtering house. And it got to the place where he was cranking up his stereo as loud as he could every day as he drove into the factory, because he knew hearing the pigs squealing, thousands of pigs squealing, he knew that at the end of every day, every one of them would be dead. And, you know, we don't think about it when we go into the store. I mean, just think of, say, L.A., New York, and Chicago, of how much we just expect that in every store we walk into, we're going to have all this food available for us, and we just expect it to be there. But, you know, because of the way that we live and eat, we're creating more and more of the market for it. So, you know, just to look at how we are interrelated, and that's a big part of what these precepts do as well, is help us focus on that.
Even gardening, I mean, I've always loved gardens, but you know, you walk by, I mean, San Diego, and I don't know about LA and here, but you know, lawns forever, and how many insects are killed so that some of the people got something green. Mm-hmm. Or even I had to give up even going into the soil because I thought I'm even, you know, mm-hmm. I didn't plant flowers. I'm killing something.
Right. Not to kill. The Theravada monastic precepts are not to dig in the ground. The Vinaya precepts, we're not supposed to dig and cultivate things. But in the Mahayana tradition, they are able to work and harvest and grow vegetables and things. So there is that difference, you know, also where many of the Mahayana monastics are vegetarian, really thinking of the Bodhisattva vow and not taking that to the level of being vegetarian. You know, the Theravada monastics eat what is offered to them. So there's that whatever is put into their bowl, you know, and not to say hold the beef or where's the beef, you know, but to accept what is offered to you. And so in the Mahayana tradition, you really go more closely to vegetarianism. So now all of these, and you realize, like Frank, you know, you realize it starts to go into a gray area, you know, with all of these. Pesticides to keep our vegetables looking fresh and wonderful. You know, the fact that we raise so many cattle for everything else, that it eliminates a lot of land for more vegetable harvest growth. So anyway, this one of killing, you know, really thinking with each of these precepts, you know, how they harm ourselves and others, and how we are to really try to hold them in the way of what am I doing to really refrain from engaging in these kind of actions. You know, particularly looking at your intention, right? And creating a negative karma, there are always four steps to that. There's the intention, the action, you know, or you're perceiving the object, you're engaging in the action, and then rejoicing in having completed that particular action. So in this idea of killing, then, you know, it's like the intention to harm another person or an animal, right? The intention arises. You have the perceived object in mind. You engage in the object, and then the final result is that other being dies before you do. And so, therefore, you are content, or you even rejoice in having killed that other being. So that creates a full karmic act. Okay. So just watching, realizing that if you've got all four of those lined up in there, that creates a much stronger karma than if you unintentionally kill an insect when you're trying to save it, something like that. Yeah. Okay, so let's go on into the next precept, which is to refrain from stealing. Okay, so again, look at that in your own practice of really trying to sustain the precepts. You know? All of these, again, are to help us wake up, right? To wake up, to broaden our understanding of interdependence and interrelatedness with all other things. Okay, stealing. Mm-hmm.
I just had a question. Once on this killing, how do you reconcile inside then if you are not a vegetarian? It seems to me you're inherently in conflict with the very basis. Right.
How do you reconcile this if you're not a vegetarian?
How do you do a practice when you're very basically giving your life seems to be directly in conflict with what you're doing?
Yeah, that our lives seem to be in conflict with vegetarianism or not being able to be vegetarian.
Yeah, I'm saying how do you, you know, if you're not a vegetarian,
yeah,
then
if you're not a vegetarian, we're indirectly involved. Well, we are, and even if we're vegetarian, there are many animals being killed, as she was saying, in any garden, in any place. Countless sentient creatures are being wiped out, even for the lettuce we eat. Yeah. So, to go more specifically to your answer, then there's some aspects about that where you are not, as a practicing Buddhist, you are not to kill something yourself for your food, kill an animal for your food, ask someone else to kill it for you, watch it being killed, that those things you shouldn't engage in. No. So, but still, there's the indirect fallout of, you know, being a meat eater. But again, you realize that just living on the planet, again, we're displacing other sentient beings. So, you know, again, it's checking your motivation, realizing that you need to sustain your health and your energy in order to practice the Dharma. And to really try to shift our mental attitude from selfish, self-cherishing, self-interest, you know, to really to thinking about how can I utilize this life well for the benefit of all beings? Yeah. How can I decrease harming and really increase benefiting others? Okay, so let's go on into the aspect of stealing and stealing here, you know, realizing that oftentimes when we're engaging in stealing, it is the mental attitude of taking something which doesn't belong to us, absconding something that belongs to others, or taking something that's not freely given. You know, you realize that, you know, when they talk about the three poisons, yeah, attachment, greed, hatred, aversion, and ignorance, confusion, all of it's being driven by confusion and ignorance, but a lot of the drive in stealing is because of greed and anger as well. That greed and anger is driving us, perceiving this idea that if we take that, that it's going to benefit me, that it's going to benefit, or it's going to really cause some, sometimes it's done with anger to rip someone else off so that they are deprived of something. Sometimes it's out of your own greed. You know? So to realize, you know, that this one of stealing has, all of these have behind it the mental attitudes of the three poisons, hatred, aversion, greed, attachment, or confusion, ignorance, you know, when we engage in all of these. So in this one, you know, we're really looking at how can we develop more respect and protecting the possessions and the rights of others so that we're also creating, again, the situation of being safe to be around. You know, if it happens that every time I go around somewhere and things start disappearing, people might not feel safe around me.
Yeah.
You know, but when people leave things around in their own home or in a public place, and yet it's still there when they come back to it, you know, you feel safe. You feel like you that others are respecting your possessions and that you can respect the possessions of others. And it just creates for a more harmonious environment. Okay? So this one is you know, that people feel freer, and you know, these are as we develop our own qualities of enlightened qualities. You know, it's our interdependence and interrelatedness with others, right? You realize that our enlightenment is dependent on others, and if we're constantly lying, ripping them off, or killing them, know that we're not creating very good circumstances for that enlightenment. Yeah. Okay, so there's a sutra where the Buddha had said, once a king allows poverty to arise in his own nation, then people will always steal to survive. You know? So to observe how that occurs on a higher governmental political level as well. You know? That there's actually enough food on the planet, but we create scarcity and because of our own greed. Okay. So to see how we can do that and observe these things in our own lives, but also on a greater level. Okay, so the next interesting one is the one on sexual misconduct. Again, looking at not exploiting or hurting others through our sexuality. There's a book by Sulak Shivaraksha. He's a Thai man. He's a barrister. He became a barrister in England, but he also was a monk for a short time in Thailand. And he has gone back to Thailand, really working with the community there. And he quotes a book called Death, Sex, and Fertility, Population in Pre-Industrial Society. It's a book that was published by Columbia University in 1987. But it's a book by Marvin Harris and Eric Ross. And they comment on how in these pre-industrial societies, female infanticide, or killing of females through starvation or through abortion. Female infanticide leads to tribal warfare, because the tribal warfare then is to kill the surplus males, which leads to the valuation of the male prowess. Prowess, there is that word again. Mm-hmm. Right? Which leads to the further starvation of female children in favor of male children. So in looking at that, you know, consider how we also still perpetuate military societies and what's going on in our world with this. And another one to look at is our corporate and political structures. And this one of imbalance between males and females. So that's more on a global level, but you know, on a personal level, sexual misconduct, in the way of harming others, through the three poisons of greed, attachment, hatred, anger, and confusion. So to observe how can we use this in a more honest way. Okay, let's see. I'll go through the last two quickly unless people have questions about that last one or comments in the last one. Because we need to do.
I'm here translated as sexual violence or adultery. Those seem to be working definitions that are thrown into this particular precept.
Adultery and
violence.
Sexual violence. Absolutely. Yes, absolutely. In here. And you, yeah. Yeah. Simplistically, but also very painfully. You know, realize how we, in our own self-interest, we engage in wrong actions. No, and you realize when you are strongly attracted to someone that we often violate our matrimonial precepts, no, our vows, because of strong attraction and our own self-interest. No?
I have a question about the, are all the, would you consider the precepts equal other than killing, said that killing maybe, is there any hierarchy of the precepts?
Is there any hierarchy on the precepts? Well, I think that they're all equally bad. but you know, there's another way of looking at it in the way of what's your particular delusion. And we tend to be inclined to one or another of them. And they also say that we're inclined to one of the three poisons, that we're inclined more towards attachment, greed, or anger, hatred, or confusion, ignorance, that we kind of have a almost like a personality tendency towards one of those. Even though we've got all three, until we're enlightened beings, that we have a tendency towards those. Okay, so Geshe-la wanted us to do a half an hour of mantra, so let me just finish these as quickly as I can. So this one on false speech then is, helping us to develop critical thinking so that we can observe and really check up our own bias and prejudice in the way of using our speech more skillfully and not harming others through lies. Now, in all of these, there is also the Buddhist view that if the bodhisattva idea of if this is beneficial for others, if something is of greater benefit for others, then those bodhisattva vows override these vinaya precepts. Okay. So in other words, if there is lying to prevent someone from being killed, for instance, then that is something that someone can engage in. Okay. So, this is really to shake up our strong grasping at our particular views. There's the Vimalakirti Sutra. It's a translation by Robert Thurman. It's a really excellent book to read. The bodhisattvas are advised to devote themselves to all sects of the world in order to convert to ecumenical tolerance those trapped by dogmatism. Okay, so to realize that view, particularly wrong view, is something that we have to keep checking up. It's our misperception of reality and our misperception of how, like, you know, Geshe-la's been speaking about, don't just gulp down teachings like a dog gulps down food, right? To really check up and observe what is it that we are accepting as our particular view. You know, I mean, not only is Geshe-la teaching, but then we also have a layer on top of that, our perception or our interpretation of the teachings. So it's really important for us to analyze and check up what is going on, what is that, you know, about lying, false speech, and really what is it that we're clinging to as well. You know? Like, it's okay to have sex with so-and-so. They really need it, or whatever, you know. I mean, I don't know. You guys know better than me. Anyway, but to look at how, again, our advertising, the propaganda in advertising and our politics are also infusing us with particular views, you know. I mean, Sulak Shivaraksha also says, you know, our new ethics or our new Bibles are, you know, the Harvard Business Review or the Wall Street Journal, and that's what we really listen to rather than really thinking about the ethics of our precepts. Okay, so the last one is intoxicants, you know. And this is where a lot of Westerners choose not to take this vow because they want that glass of wine with their meal every night. So it's oftentimes that one that they want to just say, I'm not going to take that one. You know? But again, looking at interpretation, there are many people who say, well, you know, it's the point of where we go, we actually become intoxicated. It's not that one glass of wine, right? So just look at how you hold each of these, where your gray area is in each of these. Okay, so look at how there are many things that we become dependent on and that we develop an intoxication for or a craving and dependency on. How even our medicines, you know, are powered often by the drug industries to keep the economy flowing as well. So looking at how by our own self-interest we involve others, that we engage others, that find others that are going to support and acknowledge and encourage our habit of whatever we are interested in. So to realize, you know, because of our self-interest, again, in all of these, we start to gravitate to or accumulate certain people that are going to sustain our self-interest. So this is what the Sangha is, the community of beings that help us really try to stay on track and observe our precepts, you know, that we can talk about our precepts and keep working with them. So all these five precepts then are to help us to get out of our confusion, you know, to really cleanse our minds so that we can see the nature of reality, to look at how we can benefit others rather than just engage in things that are for our self-interest. So the precepts then help keep us from wrong view. So many times, you know, it took me a really, really long time to take refuge, a really long time, because to me, I wanted to do it really, really well. And so I waited and studied for a while before taking refuge, because it's something really important and you want to keep it well. And I think that for all of us, you know, to not take the precepts lightly, but to see what is the interpretable area of it and what is the real essence, and thinking, you know, rather than going kicking and screaming into taking the precepts, looking at how in fact the precepts are to help me attain enlightenment, to become the best person, you know. So let's look at the precepts that way. So I'll stop here and we should do our mantras. Gishala suggested that we do them for half an hour. And we'll do the Om Muni Muni Maha Muni Ye Soha mantra for the Buddha, since most of you know the Om Mani Padme Hum mantra. And you can do that on your own. What we'll do is I'll do the mantras until 12:15. But if you need to leave at noon, then please go on. Annie has been asking people to record them, so their pencils and papers, to record the number of mantras. And if you can call them in or email them in, we're going to send the number of mantras that we accumulated to the Religious Council in India for the success of His Holiness's teachings, and also for the long life of Geshe-la, for our own self-interest there. But any questions? Yes, you can email the number of mantras that you accumulated to office@tdling.com.
Is there a time limit?
The time limit is we need them at the latest by Wednesday morning. We're going to send it to India Wednesday morning, so maybe Tuesday night would be good.
Could you repeat that email address?
office@tdling.com.
What's the
Kala Chakra?
Yeah, what is it?
When is it? What is it? Kala Chakra is a particular initiation that, and they say that by having that initiation three times or practicing it, then you can be reborn in the land of Shambhala, another one of the Buddha realms. And it's Kala Chakra means the wheel of time, and so it's really focused on the dimension of time and reality. The Dalai Lama's given it here a few times. The first time was in Wisconsin, and then Geshe-la hosted it in 1989 in Santa Monica. And he's also done it in Madison Square Garden, of all places. And this next time it's going to be in Amaravati. It's one of the holy Buddhist places in India. It's a very complex and complicated practice. And we have one of the mandalas here, but does someone else know more about the Kala Chakra?
It's a multi-day practice. It encompasses several days.
Yes, that's right. Tricia or Paul, do you know more about the Kala Chakra? That's what?
It's a very high tantric teaching.
It's a tantric.
And
yes.
Most people go the blessing initiation. I don't know if you should take it the price.
Yeah, that's right. And even His Holiness has acknowledged that. He said it's a very, very complicated practice, and it's true, most Tibetans and people go for the blessing, but he says actually very few are really getting it.
If you get the chance to go, I really recommend it.
Yeah.
I think it's something to do with the collective karma of the world.
Oh, right. Okay. I think that's...
He's done a lot more than he
practiced when people go to it.
Yeah. Yes, it's to help really benefit the collective karma of the world and world systems. So.
And that's what these mantras are for.
That's what these mantras are for. Yeah, for the success of His Holiness's teachings and the well-being of His Holiness. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. All right. So we'll say it together, and then you can, if you wanted to do it a little faster, you can do it on your own. And if you need to leave, it's fine too. So,
if you can't email me and you're just going to finish it today, there's a piece of paper here with your name and the name of my teacher to do just today. If you can't email me, we'll call me.
Okay. So people on the internet too can also email it into Annie at office@tdling.com. Okay. So you can use your own system of recording, or if you have your mala, then just record them. Okay. So we'll say it together. Om Muni Muni Maha Muni E Soha. So the Muni means a conqueror or a powerful one, or it's the name mantra of the Buddha. Okay? Om Muni Muni Maha Muni E Soha. 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 Om Muni Muni. Om Mani Mani Maha Mani Esaha. 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 Om Mani Mani Maha Mani Esaha
I
So complete the mantras where you come to a finishing point. And imagine that the energy of the mantras goes out around the world, through the universe, purifying all destruction, hatred, defilements, pollution. and adding the virtuous merit of our actions to the long life and success of His Holiness's teachings and for all our teachers. So let's dedicate the merit of our actions with the dedication prayers. And the last page, second paragraph, where it says, not yet been received, may the precious bodhicitta that has not yet been received, it's actually, makhepana means it's actually not yet born. So it's actually saying, may the bodhicitta that has not yet been born be born, and may that which has been born be increased and not decreased. Because of these merits, may I quickly become Guru Lord Buddha and lead each and every sentient being into his enlightened realm. May the precious bodhicitta that has not yet been born be born, and may that which has been reborn be increased and not decreased. May the precious view of emptiness, shunyata, that has not been born be born. And may that which has been born be increased and not decreased. So again, make a beautiful visualization of offering. By the virtue of offering to you, assembly of Buddhas, if visualized before me, this mandala built on a base, resplendent with flowers, saffron water, and incense, adorned with Mount Meru and the four continents, as well as with the sun and moon, may all sentient beings share its effects. Idam Guru Ratna Mandala Kamniyatayami. In the land of snowy mountains, you are the source of all happiness and good. Lord Chenrezi Chenzin Gyatso, may you stay until samsara ends. Okay, thank you for hanging in there. Just as one completion to remember the precepts, let's name them again.
No killing.
No killing.
No stealing.
No lying.
No intoxicants.
No sex. Okay, and so what are the opposites of those five? No killing would be?
Killing.
Saving life.
Oh, all right.
Saving life. Okay, the opposite of lying.
Truthful.
Speaking truthfully, speaking kindly. Okay, the opposite of, what's the next one?
Stealing.
Generosity.
Practicing generosity, really preserving the items and possessions in the lives of others. Okay. Sexual misconduct.
Loving people.
Loving people. Okay. Somebody once said sexual conduct, but no. But being others, being respectful with your body and how you use your body in your relationship to others. Okay, and the last one, intoxicants.
Sobriety.
Okay. And just really, yeah, mindfulness, yeah, balance, equanimity, and body, speech, and mind with your food and drink and all of your actions. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So we'll do our bows together.